To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black.
Wonderful. I imagine we're going to find that this is full of quotations.
Quotes and Quotes, the quotations program devised and introduced by Nigel Rees.
Hello again. Did you know that the first bad book review occurs in the Bible?
And it shall be, when thou hast made an end of reading this book, that thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it into the midst of Euphrates.
Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 63, read there by Peter Jefferson. On the panel this week, no strangers to reviews in their respective fields, the novelist and writer A.L. Kennedy, columnist on the editorial staff of the Sunday Express, Julia Hartley Brewer, the actor, playwright, and creative supremo of the National Theatre of Brent, Patrick Barlow, and the journalist, editor, historian, and author, Sir Max Hastings. We'll ease you in gently with quotations that you really should know something about. Julia Hartley Brewer, who said this?
Every prime minister needs a willy.
Oh, Margaret Thatcher.
Can you remember the circumstances?
It was William Whitelaw. It was her sort of a deputy, wasn't he? And she was of the view that everybody should have somebody who could look after the prime minister's relationship with everyone else and the dealings of government. He was the man.
Yes. This was said at a dinner given to mark his retirement through ill health in January 1988. Do you think that she noticed anything about the joke?
I'm very, very sure that Margaret Thatcher never thought there was anything remotely questionable about that joke, anything questionable about that statement. She had absolutely zero sense of humour.
It was first reported as every prime minister should have a willy, and she is then said to have added, without any effect whatsoever, that this was not to go beyond this room. Right. And you did a TV documentary with this title.
Yes, for BBC Two. Yes, Every Prime Minister Needs a Willy. And it was about deputy prime ministers. And every time I'm introduced, people mention I did this show, they assume it was something incredibly tacky. And in fact, it was very, very grand and intellectual. Obviously, I didn't write the script.
Every prime minister needs a willy. Now, Patrick Barlow, this quote has a certain relevance to you, I think.
There are 20 million women in this island, and I've got to be chained to you.
That is from the Hitchcock movie of 39 Steps, when Hannay is being nagged at by this woman he's actually falling in love with and chained to, but trying to pretend he isn't really. She's going on, and she's dirty and covered in mud, and it's all filthy, and they're running across the Scottish moors, away from the entire Scottish police force. And that's what he says.
And you know this because you adapted 39 Steps for London stage, for Broadway, for every country in the world.
Well, quite a few countries, not
it's
every
It's been
country.
An enormous success. Now, Alison Kennedy, I believe there is a connection between you and this request.
I met you at a bus stop once. Will you spend hours reading my book and giving me detailed feedback?
Yes, I do for some reason have people writing to me quite often, under the mistaken assumption that I might be able to help with their anything. When you were talking about reviews at the beginning, my first ever review was A.L. Kennedy Making Misery Tedious. Which, to be fair, it is.
I get
people who've written PhDs, which I can't understand. Somebody once gave a speech while I had to sit next to him on siphons and siphoning in the work of A.L. Kennedy. And then turned to me and said, what do you think? And it's like, I think I didn't understand a syllable of it because you're obviously much better at this than me.
And do siphons figure largely in your
I'm
books?
Not aware that I have actually knowingly employed any kind of siphoning device. I'm thinking of putting one in the next book, just maybe as a free thing strapped to the front.
And what other FAQs do you have to put on your website too?
Oh, well, I mean, people still think, sadly, even after they've met me, that I'm a man, so eventually my publishers desperately put this quote from Richard Ford, which had the word woman in the quotation, just to say she is a girl.
Right, now then, Max Hastings, please answer this question.
Did you really shoot the television?
I have to make plain, it was a very small set. It was when I was about 11 or 12, and my father was absolutely potty about guns, and he brought back all these pistols from the war. And in those days, no British house thought itself complete without a captured German pistol. But I heard a report that all these pistols were going to be taken away to keep them out of my sticky little hands. And I was horrified by this, so I hid one in a suitcase. And sitting in a London flat in the Cromwell Road, a few days later, I was watching a TV soap. One should never try and do two things at once. At the same time, I was playing with this pistol. And I pointed at the screen and flicked the trigger. And I'll remember as if it were yesterday, this cascade of glass and smoke, and all the guns were taken away and never seen again. And my father ended up in almost as much trouble as I did. But I can tell you one thing, if you're ever wondering whether if you fire a pistol in an old-fashioned mansion flat in the Cromwell Road, it'll bother the neighbours, I can reassure you that nobody complained about a thing.
So it was just an accidental explosion. You weren't commenting on the quality of the programme.
One reviewer of my book, which I called Did You Really Shoot the Television, said that his objection was that it was an accident. He felt that if I'd been making a serious social commentary on the quality of the BBC's output, then he would have had some sympathy with us.
Yeah. Indeed. Now, in round two, I ask you to identify the people, not your good selves, about whom these remarks were made. Now, Julia, at whom was this famous jibe made?
Is it always his desire to give his imitation of a semi-house-trained polecat?
Gosh, I'm thinking John Prescott, but I don't think that's going to be right.
No, it wasn't said about a Labour person, it was said about a Tory. Oh. Yes.
Oh, gosh. Cecil Parkinson?
Boris Johnson.
Yes.
Getting warmer. I'll tell you
that. No, semi-house trained.
I'll tell you that this was said by Michael Foot when he was leader of the Labour Party about a Conservative person at that time. You don't know this one.
Norman Tebbit?
Norman Tebbit, says Alison, and she's absolutely right. Yes, well done. Foote said it at an Eve of Poll rally in Ebbervale in 1983, but he had said it before in the House of Commons in 1978. Foote lost the election, and Tebbit continued to bite people in the leg for many years more. Now, Patrick, of which actor did his mother say,
if we'd known he was going to be an actor, we'd have given him a fancier name?
So think of some actors with non-fancy names.
I'm trying to think of a really dull name.
Okay, I'll give you a choice.
Okay.
It was said about either Jim Broadbent, Albert Finney, or Arthur Mullard.
It's probably Jim, is it? Jim Broadbent.
It's not your old colleague.
It's Arthur Mullard, then.
No, it's Albert Finney.
Oh, got there in the end.
It was said by Alice Finney, the mother of Albert Finney.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And when you think about it, Albert Finney is a little bit of a non-fancy name.
I do like the idea of Mrs. Mullard saying that about Arthur.
I wonder what she was called. Anyway, this was Alice Finney about Albert, her son. Now, Alison, this has been said about you, actually. We'll get on to that in a minute. Of whom was it said?
He has something of the nice in him.
Oh, Lord, yes. It's another politician, and it was a lady politician who said it of him,
yes.
And I can see his face.
It was Ann Widdecombe talking about...
Oh, Lord.
Michael Howard.
Michael Howard, yes, Max.
He was Home Secretary.
Yes.
He was bidding for the leadership.
Yes, it was in 1997, and by saying this simple thing, she helped scupper his chances of the Conservative leadership, at least that time round. And now then, Alison, Rosemary Goring, writing in the Glasgow Herald, put, there is something of the night about A.L. Kennedy.
She did, and delighted me. And if I could
what
have it on
mean?
T-shirts, I have no idea. If I smell slightly damp or I contain bats, I have no idea.
Well, the interesting thing about the Ann Widdecombe quote was, of course, that soon after that, a Labour MP, and this wasn't much reported at the time, said that Ann Widdecombe had something of the morning after the night before about her. Cruel, yes.
Moving on to Max, his of whom. I would tell you that this was said by Sir Douglas Haig in the last year of the First World War. Of whom was he writing in a letter to his wife?
A very weak-minded fellow, I'm afraid, and like the feather pillow, bears the marks of the last person who has sat on him.
The King?
No, I don't think he would have dared say it about the king.
He certainly wouldn't have been Lloyd George. I think of all the people who Haig hated, and there were a long list.
Well, this was a man considered a rather uninspiring choice as Secretary for War in the Lloyd George government.
Who was... No, I can't do it.
Well, he's disappeared from history, apart from being the target of this remark. It was the 17th Earl of Derby.
Oh, we knew that.
Of course.
I was going to say 16. And
in the end, Lloyd George, as Prime Minister, took over the Earl of Derby's responsibilities in the final months of the war. But he's remembered for that remark. Now, thank you for your letters or queries about quotes and for your emails to quote.unquote@bbc.co.uk. A listener, who perhaps wisely wishes to remain anonymous, wanted to know the origin of a saying to the effect that opinions are like a certain part of the anatomy. Everyone has one, but no two are the same. Well, Joe Kralik in Pueblo, Colorado, did the research for us on this one and found that this was a modern coarsening of a pretty old formula. By the 1970s, the saying was more usually...
Opinions are like noses. Everyone has one and no two are alike.
In 1960, there was this variation...
Opinions are like fingerprints. They never change and no two are precisely alike in every respect.
But by the 1890s, the original would appear to have been...
Men's opinions are like their watches. No two go alike, and yet each man believes his own.
We can all agree, however, that after our efforts on this programme, the four-line humorous poem is gaining its rightful place as a recognised art form. So, what have you pre-selected for us of this type? Julia, great literature?
I've gone very highfalutin on this one. This is actually a poem I remember from my childhood. My stepfather always used to say this. It's very complicated, so I do hope you can keep up. Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair. Fuzzy Wuzzy wasn't fuzzy, was he?
And that is...
Have I hit the right level?
Yeah, you have. Great literature. Four lines, too. Have you got another one of these?
Oh, well, it is four lines if you include the title as well. This is John Hegley, his poem Luton, a poem about the town of my upbringing and the conflict between my working-class origins and the middle-class status conferred upon me by a university education. I remember Luton as I'm swallowing my crouton.
Thank you. Very good. now then, Patrick Barlow.
A very great poet died in 2008 called Adrian Mitchell, wonderful man, and I knew him a little bit. He wrote a one-man version of the Battle of Trafalgar for me, which lasted 5 minutes. It was very wonderful. Anyway, he wrote some lovely children's poems, one of which is... The Satsuma has no sense of humour, but a figgle giggle. When she opens my door, my light comes on, but it goeth out when she is gone. That's the song of the faithful old fridge. This is a nice bun. Doing the best I can. Dad showed me my new half-sister. I love Dad, so I half-kissed her. I flop into our bed with thee, Ovaltine and warm Milko, and there we lie in ecstasy, watching Sergeant Bilko.
The collected work of Adrian Mitchell.
Adrian Mitchell.
Yes,
go
now, Alison.
One by somebody called Hughes Mearns, with whom I am not familiar.
He sounds Scottish to me.
Or Welsh, or both. And this will sound slightly familiar. There are a number of pastiches on this poem, and this is another one. As I was letting down my hair, I met a guy who didn't care. He didn't care again today. I love them when they get that way. Which is true. And something from Ambrose Bierce, who I think is wonderful, wrote a lovely short story called An Incident at Owl Creek Bridge. One of the best short stories ever, ever, ever. But he also did The Devil's Dictionary, which includes the definition alone in bad company, with which I heartily concur. And some of his definitions are in the form of poems. This one is Experience. To one who, journeying through night and fog, is mired neck-deep in an unwholesome bog, experience, like the rising of the dawn, reveals the path that he should not have gone.
Very good. Now then, Max.
I've chosen two by Stevie Smith. First one, if you cannot have your dear husband for a comfort and a delight, for a breadwinner and a crosspatch, for a sofa, a chair or a hot water bottle... One can use him as a cross to be born. And the other one, People who are always praising the past, and especially the times of faith as best, ought to go and live in the Middle Ages and be burnt at the stake as witches and sages.
Two by Stevie Smith then. Thank you very much. Well, back to the quiz, and once more to what we call detached lyrics, quotations from song lyrics that might be that little bit more difficult to recognise when divorced from the music and the context. Julie, you're smiling eagerly in anticipation.
Slightly terrified, I think, was the word I was looking for.
Okay, all right, well, here we go. Julia, where does this bit of lyric come from?
And don't be afraid of the dark.
Oh, he's humming it next to me. No, I don't know it.
Patrick, are you going to hum it out?
Mm-mm-mm. And don't be afraid of the dark.
You got the song?
But I don't know what the song's called, though.
Alison?
You'll Never Walk Alone.
We'll Never Walk Alone.
Yes. Oh. From the Rodgers and Hammerstein song, You'll Never Walk Alone. And now the anthem of... anthem of football crowds. Originally in Carousel, when you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. Lyric by Oscar Hammerstein II. Now, Patrick, for you, another fragment of popular song. What's it from?
What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt.
What do you... Another day older and deeper in debt. Ah, what is that?
The audience knows. I will tell you that it was popularised in the 1950s.
What did you say? 16 tons.
What? Yes. But well, you obviously remember the song, even if you
know
the title.
The tune.
Yes, popularised in the 1950s by Tennessee Ernie Ford. It's the song 16 Tons, written by Merle Travis. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Say, brother, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Company
stow is the actual rhyme, but the company store. Alice, back to a fragment of an anthem for football crowds, and indeed any sort of crowd in this country.
Wider still and wider.
Oh, Land of Hope and Glory.
Yes, you got it. Words by A.C. Benson, who fitted them to the big tune of Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, number one, for the coronation of Edward VII.
With the very high note that nobody ever actually gets.
Yeah, well, just to refresh your memory and possibly to hear the high note, this is what the words sound like in the context of a hinge and bracket performance.
Yes. I can't go on.
Max Hastings, your detached lyric might come from something similar.
If England means as much to you as England means to me.
No. They all know.
Alison?
They'll always be in England.
Yes, from the song, They'll Always Be in England, with words by Hugh Charles and music by Ross Parker and Harry Parr Davis. And at the outbreak of war... In September 1939, the song became a hit for Vera Lynn, and 200,000 copies of the sheet music were sold. And Charles and Parker were also responsible for her We'll Meet Again, written in the same year, so they were a formidable songwriting duo.
Or We'll Meet Again, as it was at the time.
Exactly, yes.
The only football chant I've ever known was about Frank Leboeuf. I don't even know which team he was playing for, but apparently they used to chant in the football stadiums, he's here, he's there, he's every beeping where, he's Frank Leboeuf, he's Frank Leboeuf. And he went on television saying he felt quite uncomfortable that people were chanting and saying rude words in the stadium with young children present. And that afternoon, the chant changed to, he's here, he's there, we're not allowed to swear, he's Frank Leboeuf.
Very good. Well, enough of bits of anthems. We turn now to finishing off quotations. Simply, can you complete these quotations as they should be or as you think fit? Julia, this is a proverbial saying, but how does it finish?
If ifs and ands were pots and pans, there'd be...
Oh, I've got to get one right.
You will, I promise. If ifs and ands were pots and pans, there'd be no...
Work for idle hands or something?
No, work for tinker's hands. Tinker's hands. Yes, almost got it, yes. And it means something like, if we could achieve what we want by merely wishing, life would be very easy.
Phew.
Yes, you got one.
Ish.
Ish. And Patrick, this is almost a proverbial expression too, but more modern. How would you finish it off?
Acting is easy, as long as you just learn your lines and...
Don't bump into the furniture.
Yes.
But I don't know who said that. Was it...
Everybody has said it.
Gielgud.
Spencer Tracy, Alfred Lunt, Ronald Reagan, Mel Coward, they've all said
it. Ronald Reagan needed to say it.
And is it true? Is it good advice?
No, it's ridiculous. If you bump into the furniture, then you shouldn't be on the stage in the first place. Anyway, most plays don't have any furniture because there's no budget anymore for just have open stages, so you don't have to worry about that.
Oh,
learning lines over is a whole other issue, but I won't go into that.
Yeah, okay. Now, Alison, I think it's time we finished off some Shakespeare.
Oh, yes, I would be the one to pick for that.
Yes,
absolutely.
I thought so. Can you finish off what Hamlet says?
Oh, God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space.
I was going to complete that bit. I don't know what he says.
Were it not that I have...
a pain in my elbow.
Doesn't need to rhyme.
Were it not that I have...
I'm trying to help you here.
We're sending a lot of
Shakesperean...
Well, what answer is it you're sending over?
Oh, nothing of any
use. We don't know, though.
I'm sending over the answer to his question.
Were it not that I have...
Oh, God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space. Were it not that I have...
My mum's going to shout at me so much. That isn't what he said.
No. Were it not that I have bad...
Dreams.
Yes.
I've got one word.
And Max, can you finish off this mighty speech?
The day may dawn when fair play, love for one's fellow men, respect for justice and freedom... will enable tormented generations to march forth serene and triumphant from the hideous epoch in which we have to dwell. Meanwhile...
Churchill, I presume.
It was Churchill, yes. It was from his last major speech in the House of Commons as Prime Minister in 1955.
One of the awful things about Churchill quotations is that there's so fantastically many of them that remembering more than a handful is jolly difficult.
Part of this one has been used as the title of a book. The next word is never.
Never despair?
Well, that's the last one. Never flinch, never weary, never despair. Wonderful stuff. And now it's time to leave questions aside and for me to ask you to nominate the most quotable people you have ever met. Julia?
Well, I'm not sure this is suitable for a Radio 4 audience, but Sid Waddell, who some of you may know as the darts commentator. It's very strange because he's an incredibly erudite man. He's got a degree from Cambridge and things, and yet he genuinely does believe that Phil Taylor, who is a weeble-shaped man wearing a polyester shirt, is the greatest sportsman who've ever lived. And he really does believe this, and he says these wonderful things in the commentary, things like... When Alexander of Macedonia was 33, he cried salt tears because there were no more worlds to conquer. Bristow is only 27. eat your heart out, Harold Pinter. We've got drama with a capital D in Essex. And if you had to throw a knife at your wife in the circus, you'd want to throw it like that.
Oh, the highly quotable Sid Waddell. Let's go to Max Hastings.
I'm going to nominate my mother, who was a journalist called Anne Scott James, who, till her death last year at the age of 96, had a pretty trenchant view of humanity. And I remember one of the first things I can remember saying to me about my father, your father wrote brilliantly about slight subjects, but the more serious the theme and the more ridiculous his view of it. When once I was complaining to her that our family didn't seem very got together, she said... All families are dysfunctional. And on one occasion, she said, you still hold your childhood against me, don't you? I said, you're quite wrong about that. I don't believe in blaming anybody for the long-distant past. But did I have a happy childhood? No, I didn't. My mother thought for a moment. She said, who did you ever hear of who did anything with their lives who had a happy childhood?
Probably true. Alison, who's going to be your most quotable person or persons?
Well, I was trying to think of famous people that I'd come across, but I get so nervous I'm trying to suppress it tonight, in the presence of famous people. I tend to just fall over or drop things. So what famous people say to me tends to be variations on a theme of, are you all right? Which isn't all that quotable. But two people in front of the sheet. One guy, Barry Russell, who's a lecturer of mine, and he always gave first years a lecture about the Enlightenment, and he always started the lecture by saying, because you are here and because you are a student, you are part of the Enlightenment. It's not history. It's now. And I never forgot that. And that's the one moment when, you know, sitting in my army greatcoat with my boots and no money, I actually felt proud of being a student. And I do tell it to people who are allegedly students of mine. And the other one, my grandfather was a middleweight amateur boxer. And he always used to say, he was a big fibber, so this may not be true, but he always said he only lost his first fight because he was scared. And he used to say, if you're scared, it means they don't beat you, you beat yourself. So don't be scared. But he was a great guy, my grandfather. Joseph Price.
Patrick Barlow, famous person or family person?
No, he's family. My partner's father, who is from New South Wales, and he's a great, wonderful, dyed-in-the-wool, salt-of-the-earth Aussie. And he does call the Lou the Danny. And says fair dinkum quite often, which I never thought people really said. But he has this wonderful things he says in conversation. He says he wouldn't buy a round if a shark bit him. He'll talk the leg off of an iron pot. And he says, I can't do anything right now. I'm too busy. I'm as busy as a centipede skipping. He just says it to you. And you're going writing it down. To Brian, same. Says this is about his brother. He's a bag of nerves. He's as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. That's Brian Shields, God bless him.
God bless him. Thank you, Brian Shields. Yeah. And finally, we've looked before at those little slogans, tags, verbal logos, if you like, that every organisation seems to have these days. For example, we mentioned how the northeast of England has been promoted with the interesting slogan,
passionate people, passionate places.
Which could very well be true. But now, Adrian Blunt has spotted this somewhat similar tag at the Office of the Commissioner for Public Appointments in Scotland.
Passionate about people, passionate about public appointments.
Well, it takes all sorts. From quote unquote. Goodbye now.
Taking part in quote-unquote were Patrick Barlow, Julia Hartley-Brewer, A.L. Kennedy and Sir Max Hastings. The quotations were read by me, Peter Jefferson. Nigel Rees devised and introduced the programme, and the producer was Sam Bryant.